had not anticipated that I would have to collaborate with Michael Hutchin. But it's a thought. Thank you for the invitation, Christina. Thank you for your kind words. Thank you to the dean for a very fortunate and very timely introduction. My topic is precisely what Christina had in mind, and I want to begin now, and if there are any questions about what I'm about to present, I'll be very happy to answer them. You've got the Velázquez painting, the Meninas, which I will refer to in my talk, and it gives some better visual for you than myself. Let me get into my presentation. There are numerous ways of doing research in the humanities that are both collaborative and interdisciplinary. I can speak about one that we have developed here in Canada in comparative literature that has been implemented now in diverse centers of research around the world. I'm referring to the comparative history of literary cultures. I'm pleased to give public recognition to three of our colleagues who were central to the project. Linda Hutchin was the co-director of the Literary History Project with me. She worked on all aspects of this project, from the preliminary meetings with prospective collaborators to the copy editing of thousands of pages of translated texts, as she well remembers, and so does Michael. And Maria Elena de Valdez, my wife, who was chief of staff of research collaborators, of our research assistants, and the principal copy editor of the entire project. And finally, Cristina Santos, the most dedicated of our research assistants, who stayed with us beyond the end of our funding to assist in copy editing. Few people would do that. I was first introduced to a new way of writing cultural history in 1972 in Paris, when I was the guest of French philosopher Paul Ricoeur. It was there that I learned about the Annales School of Historical Research, and I met Fernand Braudel. Braudel revolutionized historical research in Europe when he challenged the standard paradigm of describing events and explaining the direct and indirect factors that cause them. The flaw in this approach, Braudel argued, was that the primary causes were not previous events, but rather the material infrastructure and social conditions of the agents who enacted those events. Without purporting to do so, Braudel was laying the groundwork for interdisciplinary historical research. Braudel's doctoral thesis was the Mediterranean and the Mediterranean world in the age of Philip II, written over an extended period of 10 years, four of which, I may say, were in a German prisoner of war camp. The aim of this multi-volume work was to recreate the history of the Mediterranean world in its totality. It was organized in three main parts, each of which corresponds to a particular dimension of historical time. The first was the material environment of the Mediterranean, which deals with the sea, the land, the constraints this geography imposed on the human occupation, and the resources that it offered. The second was the collective destiny of the inhabitants of the Mediterranean region, the rhythm of life, the series of overlapping histories of the various cultural centers, and the transformations that resulted from their interaction. The third part of Braudel's model treated the events, the politics, and the people, thus finally arriving at what most historians had previously considered the only subject of history. But in Braudel's approach, the social and material context comes first. The subsequent narrative of historical events is therefore completely contextualized in a world that conditions the developments. And this is central to our thinking. Some material and social factors remained over a long time. Others changed gradually and as such created periods of unequal duration with ruptures, and others that were longer were periods of development, or as he called them, la longue durée. The thesis was defended in 1947 and was published in two large volumes in 1949. It was not translated to English until 1972, which explains the lag in recognition in North America. During the period that followed the 1949 publication, Braudel undertook extensive discussions with sociologists, economists, anthropologists, which gave rise to cultural geography and what he called the history of culture. One of the most important lessons Braudel taught me was his approach to interdisciplinary research. This research, he argued, has to be based on mutual respect and dialogue. Without mutual respect and dialogue, there is no future. Each scholar has to contribute his part to the common inquiry from the vantage point of his or her discipline, not in isolation, but rather in a spirit of complementarity to the other disciplines. This fundamental insight is what has been lacking in much of the lamentable work of cultural studies over the last quarter century. You must have mutual respect of the other disciplines and dialogue. My encounter with French historiography was an awakening to the possibilities for rethinking literary history. How can we examine literature, I asked myself, which is the highest form of cultural expression, without the consideration of the context from which literature developed, or consider how it has interacted with other literatures? As long as we kept literary works closed up in national genre and period constraints, we were only observing the surface of who wrote what and when. And this, my friends, is nothing more than a chronology of names and dates. David Perkins, Harvard University, wrote in 1992 that literary history as history was not possible because the polysemic nature of literature defied historical description. According to Perkins, the best the literary historian can achieve is an accurate description of the literary work's publication as a historical event. But all attempts to describe historical origins and causation cannot rise above speculation. The fundamental category error in Perkins' otherwise excellent analysis of literary history lies in that he took the book and the author as the primary subject of literary history. We in the project, Lind and I, we in turn consider the relationship between the text and the context to be the subject of our history of literary culture. It is abundantly clear that the study of literary culture demands interdisciplinary collaboration. The problem is, how does one organize such a project without falling into the fragmentation of an anthology instead of a history? The organizational skills of another friend, the comparatist Siva Ben-Porat of Tel Aviv University, helped me develop a research plan of three interdependent parts. First, establish a contextual frame for a literary culture. Second, develop the synopsis of institutional literary production. And finally, third, produce the narrative description of literary discourse in a given cultural region. In this plan, each part builds on the previous one and moves the historical narrative toward its culmination in the history of literary discourse in all its complexity and richness. I can offer an analogy that may help explain how our plan works. If you recall a famous painting of Diego Velázquez, Las Meninas, the frame encompasses the artist's studio in Madrid's Alcázar Palace, with a five-year-old Infanta Margarita and her entourage in the foreground, with other courtiers elsewhere in the picture, and the king, Philip IV, and his queen, Mariana, reflected in a mirror on the back wall. The figure of the artist is on the left side, paintbrush and palette on his hands, standing before a huge canvas we see only from the back. We can surmise that Velázquez is painting the royal couple, who supposedly pose beyond the easel. Another possible reading of the painting is that Velázquez is representing the Infanta, who has been surprised by the arrival of her parents. Adding to the enigma, there is an unknown man seen only through an open door in the background. Not to be forgotten is the fact that in the foreground, the Infanta's dwarf looks directly at the royal couple, as does the artist, which of course is the space of the painting's spectators that we occupy. How does the analogy work? This way. The frame encloses the scene and gives it spatial location in the royal palace. The figures in the painting each require a synopsis of relationships and purpose. And finally, all the figures in relation to each other in the frame give us the narrative or narratives of the painting. This is what we propose to do for Latin America and East Central Europe. There are a number of theoretical assumptions in this plan that should be acknowledged, such as the premise that literature as the individual use of the cultural habitat we call language is a social creation and should not be isolated from its social context for purposes of analysis. Another equally fundamental assumption is that literary discourse is in a symbiotic relationship with other forms of cultural discourse, such as scientific, religious, and political discourse. There are also a number of practical problems inherent in this plan. First and foremost, as all in academic life will know what I refer to, how does one obtain collaboration from scholars in diverse disciplines to work toward the historical elaboration of a narrative none of them have even encountered, a history of literary culture? A far greater problem is how to give unity of purpose and direction to the distinct contributions. The answer to the first problem is that all collaborators have to understand the plan and accept to be part of it. The second problem is an intellectual jigsaw puzzle in which each article has to be carefully written and very carefully edited in order to create the full narrative. We began considering, as Linda will recall, five different regions whose cultural history could best be addressed through a comparative history of literary culture: Latin America, East Central Europe, Sub-Saharan Africa, North Africa, and East Asia. Common sense in the Canada Council prevailed, and we decided on two projects to run concurrently over the five-year period of the grant. In November 1995, the Canada Council awarded us a major grant to take up the Latin American and East Central Europe projects. This grant was enhanced with a substantial grant from the University of Toronto. On January 2, 1996, we began the five-year grant that ended in 2001. It would take two more years to conclude the copy editing of the three-volume, 8,000-page Literary Cultures of Latin America, A Comparative History, which was published by Oxford University Press in May 2004. The East Central Europe Project published its first volume in 2004 with Benjamins of Amsterdam, and the fourth and final volume has just come out last December. Among the numerous reviews of the Latin American history, the first and most appropriate for this lecture was published in the Times Literary Supplement in London, 3 months after the history. The reviewer wrote that this work, as significant as it was for the study of Latin America, represented a paradigm shift for the humanities, and that indeed is the point of this lecture. Our colleagues in the sciences turned to interdisciplinary collaboration as the basic disciplines of physics, chemistry, and biology were confronted with the growing complexity of research. As one scientist told me, the real world does not conform to our arbitrary disciplinary borders and departments. We in the humanities have arrived much later to the same conclusion. The lesson we have learned is basic: not to abandon our disciplinary domain, but to think beyond our traditional borders as we probe into historical mutations and changes in social discourse. When we accept to approach literature as the individual expression within a historical and cultural context, we must go beyond the traditional disciplinary borders and seek out the views of our counterparts, our fellow scholars, in the related disciplines of the social sciences. I plan to describe our concept of literary culture through the research plan I have outlined: the contextual frame, the synopsis, and finally the history of the discourse of the imagination, or as Northrop Frye would put it, the legacy of the educated imagination. The concept of frame is, of course, metaphorical. Just as a frame marks off a painting, it encloses it and also focuses our attention on details that would be lost in the general scene. So too does the frame of a literary culture enclose and concentrate. Our frame encompasses a specific cultural region over a determined time span. Our Latin American project covered most of the Americas, from the Argentinian Patagonia to the southwest of the United States, a vast, diverse, and highly complex area. Our time span was from the 14th century to the 20th century. This area speaks primarily in Spanish and Portuguese, but also Mayan, Zapotec, Nahuatl, Mixtec, Arawak, Payés, Guarani, Quechua, and Aymara, to name only those Native American languages with more than a million speakers each. In Mexico alone, there are more than 200 active languages with thousands of speakers, and I have not considered the thousands of languages that are now extinct and have not left a written record of their culture. The common denominator in this continent we call North and South America is that the native populations were conquered and colonized by the Spanish and Portuguese empires in the 15th century. And yet, in spite of the diversity of geography, language, and demography, there is a cultural process that is distinct and interrelated. The cultural links are in evidence at all levels, from literature to popular culture. The function of the frame is to be inclusive and also relational. But as I have said before, this is not an anthology. It is not an encyclopedia. It is a history. Therefore, the historical process must be present at all aspects of the contextual frame. For example, we must take care to describe how literary production began and developed, but also to point out who was permitted to participate and who was excluded. The vast majority of the native population was not taken into account, but there were two saving factors, and these were the translation schools that preserved some of the pre-Hispanic history and culture, and above all, the vitality of the oral tradition in the major Native American language groups such as Nahuatl and Quechua. Literacy was slow in developing in those regions with a large Native population, which had survived the destruction of the conquest. In other areas, especially the Caribbean and northeastern Brazil, the vast numbers of African slaves were brought into the colonies to take the place of the decimated Native American population were also deprived of a written language, in most cases, even of an oral tradition, through a colonial policy of separating slaves from the same West African area. Our frame accounts for the discursive diversity that characterizes the history of this literary culture. The discourse of religion was a dominant force during the first 200 years of colonial Latin America. The 18th century brought in a radical new discourse, the scientific and political writing of the Enlightenment in Western Europe. This brought about an intellectual revolution among the literate elite. The primary discourse of the 19th century was political, as the independence movement ran from Argentina to Mexico. By 1820, all the present countries of Latin America except Brazil were independent nations. It would not be until 1891 that Brazil broke its ties with Portugal, and it was a nonviolent separation. This was a century when the prominent public discourse was political, tinged with romanticism, as all the Latin American nations sought to establish their identity as different from their colonial past. And in those countries, with a large indigenous population, there was also the need to appear to be different from pre-Hispanic roots. Another factor encompassed in our frame was the unprecedented expansion of popular culture beyond the unlettered population. It reached into all aspects of literary culture in Latin America. In those nations that had a highly developed legacy from pre-Hispanic culture, such as Peru, Bolivia, Ecuador, Guatemala, and Mexico, this expansion marked a re-evaluation of the pre-Hispanic past and its presence in the 20th century, with artists such as Diego Rivera and Frida Kahlo, and in literature with writers such as Miguel Ángel Asturias from Guatemala, José María Arguedas from Peru, Carlos Fuentes, Octavio Paz, and Juan Rulfo from Mexico. But by far, the strongest socially powerful popularist artistic expression in the 20th century was the cinema. The cinema cut through the social and class barriers that had come down from the long colonial past. The Latin American Charlie Chaplin was Mario Moreno, better known as Cantinflas, whose films all featured social differences between the upper and lower classes. The diversity of cultural voices I have touched upon in this description of the material encompassed in the frame almost defies examination. It defies examination unless we bring into in the conceptual focus of the synopsis. The concept of synopsis comes from the Greek as scene, and in our usage, it is the conspectus of the whole through specific focal points. And these focal points in the history of literary culture are the cities, where literary discourse thrives, and within these centers of activity, we began by considering the institutions that support, enable, or sometimes enable to attempt to curtail and control literary expression, such as the case with the state and church censorship. The question, how do we determine cultural centers and describe the historical development? Since we are dealing with continental and linguistic diversity, we must look at the production and diffusion of literary discourse, both oral and written. The place to start is to examine where poets meet with each other and with their public. The political capital of a country is often also a cultural center, but there are important exceptions. In countries such as Argentina and Mexico, the undisputed center of literary culture is the capital city. But in Brazil and Colombia, there are various independent cultural centers. In Brazil, such as Minas Gerais, Sao Paulo, Salvador, Bahia, Rio de Janeiro, or Porto Alegre. In Colombia, besides Bogota, there is the very Caribbean Cartagena. The synopsis of literary cultures allows us to consider historical patterns and differences in response to the changing political and economic conditions of the cultural centers. This information is the foundation for the third part of this history of Latin American literary cultures, which is the history of the cultural imagination over 500 years of Latin America. Until the 20th century, Latin American literature was, with a few notable exceptions, was derivative from European literatures, especially Spanish and French. But the long submerged cultural legacy implicit in the continent's cultural heterogeneity changed the literary discourse of the continent into a unique syncretic expression. Latin American literature in the 20th century is a complex, rich, and new aesthetic. By mid-century, a regional literature had been catapulted into a world literature. The century began with major political ruptures: the Mexican Revolution of 1910, the nationalization of foreign oil companies in Mexico, the Cuban Revolution, the ousted Cuban Nicaraguan dictators, the military dictatorships of Uruguay, Argentina, and Chile, with strong backing of the CIA, the takeover of large parts of Colombia and Central America by revolutionary movements, and I must add with great sadness, the destruction of northern Mexico by criminal gangs taking illicit drugs to the United States, armed with weapons from Arizona and Texas. And finally, a positive note, the rise of a strong democratic government in Brazil with the long-awaited arrival of this major part of South America as a world economic power. All of this turmoil and growth, both positive and negative, came about as the intellectual forces throughout Latin America matured and its writers collectively became a powerful creative voice throughout the second half of the century. Readers in Europe and English North America found unexpected rewards in the works of writers like Jorge Luis Borges, Octavio Paz, Carlos Fuentes, Pablo Neruda, Julio Cortázar, Gabriel García Márquez, and belatedly, Mario Vargas Llosa. I say belatedly because I was told that the Swedish Academy had him on the short list for the Nobel Prize in Literature for 20 years, and it deferred it until this year because Latin America had had so many rewards. Thus, a century of revolution, foreign invasions, social and political upheaval, and economic growth was also a century of literary discourse tempered by centuries of foreign and domestic abuse of the people, enriched by a highly diversified legacy from the pre-Hispanic past, and driven by the social unrest against corruption, which finally found its own voice and surprised itself that it had something to say to the world, that the world was listening. How does one put together a narrative history of literary discourse as the one I have just described? There's only one answer: by developing interdisciplinary collaboration. This history, Latin American Literary Cultures, A Comparative History, had an editorial staff of 3 colleagues, 5 graduate student research assistants, 4 undergraduate interns, 27 section coordinators, and 188 collaborators writing in 4 languages, 24 translators, unprecedented financial support from the Canada Council and the University of Toronto, and most important of all, a commitment by all to publish the first comparative history of literary culture. I am pleased to report that our plan has now been used successfully in the 4-volume History of Literary Cultures of East Central Europe, a three-volume history of the Iberian Peninsula from Roman times to the present, and the history of literary cultures of Nordic Europe, now in process. I thank you so much for your attention.